Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a revolution that has threatened for years to blow the television schedule off the air and onto your hard drive, finally kicked in last week. Network giants CBS and NBC joined ABC in offering primetime TV shows on demand. That means primetime is now your time, whenever that may be. And the same for the kids. Nickelodeon is now stuffing SpongeBob SquarePants into a Hasbro video pod. Insiders say this is all just the beginning. The program director sitting in New York determining what you watch and when you watch it is getting the boot. The Madison Avenue ad-based TV business has peaked, and the brave new world of consumer-directed TV distribution with all that implies has begun. This hour On Point, television's on-demand future and what it means for TV, for you, and for what we'll see. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to throw off the evening schedule and watch what you want when you want it? Are you ready for the on-demand era? Does the country lose something when we aren't watching together alone anymore? Or is this liberation? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Tom Lowry, senior media writer at Businessweek magazine and co-author of the story The End of TV as You Know It in the current issue of Businessweek. Tom Lowry, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And joining us from Kansas City is Aaron Barnhart. He's television critic for the Kansas City Star. Aaron Barnhart, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Tom.
Tom Lowry, first to you. What's going on? What's the business dynamic driving TV in the announcements of the last month here?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with, consumers. The consumers have now kind of been empowered, and a lot of media companies are having to respond to that. And that is that, they want their media, whether it's sports or news or TV shows, when they want it and they want it how they want it in terms of how it's delivered. And I think a lot of networks are responding to that because they also see that their own sort of, the model they've had for years in terms of a prime time has dwindled, and the ad dollars are all migrating to the internet.
And you write that is truly happening, even though, $17, $18 billion in network TV ads now, you write, online take much, much smaller, but the online take growing 40% a year, so galloping up alongside the networks.
Right. Now, the primetime ratings have declined, let's say, about 40% since 1977, yet the networks have still been able to increase their revenues because they charge more for those ads. That's not going to last forever, and I think that a lot of network executives realize that and see the explosion on the web in terms of advertising and how advertisers, like the measurability of the web. They like to be able to track who is actually looking at their ads and who those people are that are looking at their ads in terms of the demographics of the folks that are either doing kind of a video streaming ad or clicking on and clicking through.
You can know pretty much exactly who's watching what. As evidence of this consumer demand, you cite the example of eDonkey. Describe for us what eDonkey is, Tom.
eDonkey is a file sharing service that, has some free programming on it, and it accounts for a great deal of the traffic on the web today. And these are just the kinds of services that the network, that give the network executives fits because, they see that people responding to eDonkey are competing for against the primetime shows that they're putting on.
And you say sites like eDonkey, where you can download TV shows and movies and music, they now account for half of all the volume of data that's moving in any given day on the web. 3 million people using eDonkey at any given time, downloading all kinds of entertainment.
And that just shows you that the barriers, the barriers to entry are so much lower on the web. And that, the network executives really have to worry about that in terms of programming competitors.
Aaron Barnhart, what is this going to mean for good old American TV watchers, those who are left out there who aren't part of the eDonkey crowd, or even those who are? Are we going to have the same kind of television shows when people are downloading what they want, when they want it, or are we going to have a whole new kind of narrative line, new structure, new kinds of drama? What?
Well, I think that
I think that what you're seeing now is that the large population out there is going to get to enjoy now the same kind of convenience in getting programs on demand that the early adopters have had now for 5 or 6 years. I mean, I got my first DVR, digital video recorder, before the new millennium. And you know, I'm part of that group of the population who have already altered my television viewing habits to watch programs that are queuing up silently on this pizza box that I have sitting on top of my TV set.
So it's not new for you, but now the masses are going to be invited into that same dance. Does it change what television is, Aaron?
Well, I think that in the sense that prime time is going to be the driver of all the revenues, no. I mean, I think in the short term, what we're going to see with prime time and on-demand programming is that only the programs that are certifiable minted hits on old media in prime time, those are going to be the only things that go and make money for these same networks in on-demand. A lot of the impasse that's really existed up until now, because really there was no technological boundary standing in the way of most people with cable television being able to get these things on demand.
Right.
Up until now, but up until now, there have been all of these business boundaries, and it's kind of interesting that I think the event that really broke the logjam was when Apple Computer made the deal with Disney last month to offer select hit programs from ABC to this new video iPod. It's kind of interesting that announcement caught a lot of people off guard and set in motion the events that we're now seeing with CBS and NBC jumping on board doing their own on-demand deals.
And now it's a cascade of deals. Tom Lowry, I wish you'd walk us through some of those. I mean, we began with, as Aaron says, Disney, which owns ABC, saying, yes, Desperate Housewives and Lost, you download on iTunes. Walk us through, I mean, even right up until today, we've got news coming out from, there was NBC and CBS and Warner Brothers and SpongeBob SquarePants. Take us through these, Tom.
I agree with Aaron that I think the Jobs announcement was definitely a catalyst for this. I mean, you started out with Comedy Central announced that it would be launching on November 1st a broadband channel called Motherload, which would include content from both the channel itself, shows from Comedy Central, as well as original shows just done for the broadband channel.
Right.
Then you had, last Monday, you had NBC Nightly News announcing that it would rebroadcast or reshow its Nightly News with Brian Williams on MSNBC.com. Another shift there.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had TiVo and Yahoo announcing a deal where you could program your TiVo from a Yahoo TV portal. On the same day, you had the NBC Direct TV deal where, some primetime shows on NBC would be available through Direct TV if you owned a TVR. And then the CBS
at 99 cents
at
per
99
show.
Cents. And then a very similar deal from CBS with Comcast, in which it was going to provide some of its hit shows, including CSI, at 99 cents in markets where it owned the affiliates.
Why is that important, the owning the affiliate piece of this, Tom?
Because they, the affiliates, let's say an affiliate that is owned by a different company than CBS would be very concerned that their audience was going to be cannibalized if you were going to offer this service in VOD. So I don't think that, in terms of the Apple deal, I think a lot of networks kind of rushed to respond to that, and I don't think the negotiations have been worked out yet with affiliates in terms of how that affects their business and relationships, as well as some of the agreements with talent in terms of how, the actors, the writers, are going to be compensated for programs that are shown in VOD and on the Internet.
Of course, big issues there as well. You write that big names like Larry David or big sort of producers like Mark Burnett may go off and do their own direct-to-consumer work over the television. And then this new announcement, Tom Lowry, from America Online and Warner Brothers, almost 5,000 shows. Was it Chico and the Man and Eight is Enough and Welcome Back, Kotter are going to be offered over AOL, this new Into TV service.
And this, I think, is just a way to sort of make some money off of shows that have no demand in syndication anymore. It's just a way, you know, there might be somebody out there that's willing to pay for an old episode or two of Welcome Back, Kotter. So it's a way to sort of dust off the old shows that have been on the shelves and exploit it through the AOL service.
Aaron Barnhart, yes. Does this mean we're not going to have, I mean, we already talked for the last several decades about Americans, you know, around the electronic hearth, which meant they were kind of together watching TV shows, but very apart as well, watching in their own cocoon in the pale blue light alone. Is even that kind of connection of the common viewing of shows at the same time or the same, you know, kind of big three is long gone, but the television commons, is it going away with this new technology?
Well, I think that Tom Lowry alluded to this earlier when he talked about the historic drop-off in audience viewing over the last three decades. The fact is that the most popular program on television, CSI, is watched now by fewer people than watched in terms of absolute viewers, is watched by far fewer viewers than were watching hit shows or even the number two rated show 30 years ago. So the mind share that any particular program has is less than it ever was. But its reach, ironically, through these new technologies can be greater. And let me go back to that WB deal that you announced, some of these older classic programs.
Yeah, AOL, WB, Today, yesterday.
For which there is, in fact, no rerun market anymore. And really, you know, some of these titles that you mentioned, I haven't even seen them on DVD. But what's really going to propel this forward are, in fact, the same things that propelled television forward, which are the big, big hit shows. And the ability to watch a CSI or an episode of Lost on your phone the next day, while we don't know exactly how that's going to work out and if people want to watch the whole episode or just part of it.
Mm. But it's coming. It's coming. We've got to take a break, and I know we have to lose Tom Lowry here. Tom Lowry at Business Week, thank you very much for being with us.
Okay, thanks very much.
Aaron Barnhart, stand by. We're talking about TV's on-demand era. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about television's on-demand future, becoming increasingly present, and what it means for TV, for you, and for what we will see. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Are you ready for the on-demand era of television? Will you miss the fireside community of viewers, the electronic hearth that TV has become? And what will TV become when it's pouring through many different outlets on whatever schedule you like? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined from Kansas City, Missouri by Aaron Barnhart, television critic for the Kansas City Star. We're joined right now from Boston by Jim Nail, principal analyst at Forrester Research. He's co-author of a new report arguing that the TV schedule will soon be as irrelevant as last night's news. Jim Nail, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Take us further into the economics that are driving this. Is the old advertising model still working? Is Madison Avenue, their relationship with network television still on the rails here or not?
Well, that's clearly under a lot of change, as your speakers have spoken about. But, you know, one of the myths here is that this is the end of the advertising model. Far from it. The advertising model is still going to provide the bulk of network revenues for the foreseeable future. But what happens is, no matter how you slice this idea that people, you know, won't watch it when it's broadcast and they'll download it and watch it later, or they'll watch it on VOD, sure, the audiences may drop a little bit and therefore ad rates will drop a little bit, but the revenue they pay for the ability to watch it on demand will far more than make up for it, and in fact, the networks and the program creators stand to make a lot more money.
But if I download a show, whatever it might be, for a CSI for 99 cents, do I still have to watch ads, Jim?
Well, in the current plans, no. You know, certainly, the Disney iTunes deal, you get the 40 minutes of the programming without the 20 minutes of the ads.
And how's that likely to evolve over time? Will I have a choice, like 99 cents, and there are no ads? 40 cents and it's got some ads free and it's full of ads, or what's out there?
We believe there will be choice evolving. Because as you look at the cable television landscape, sure, there are premium channels that you only get if you pay for it, but still the bulk of the revenue, like 85% of the revenue in the cable business, comes from the basic subscription fee to the channels that are advertising supported. So yes, there's a small group of consumers willing to pay some money in order to get ad-free programming on premium channels, but still the bulk of the audience will respond to that idea of, gee, it's free. If I watch a few ads, you know, I'll save my 99 cents or $2.49.
In fact, Tom, if I can speak to that.
Aaron Barnhart, please. Yeah.
I attended a presentation by CBS's head of research, David Poltrak, last year, in which they've been testing consumer responses at their big research facility in Las Vegas, and they found that when offered a choice between a slightly more expensive episode of CSI without commercials or a slightly less expensive episode with a limited number of commercials that they would have to watch, 2 out of 3, in fact, went for the cheaper commercial-supported one. And I think that's the power of the hit show. Now, again, CBS also announced last week that they were offering a program called Threshold to watch commercial-free to download on their website, cbs.com. Well, that's an example of bringing a horse to the water. But a show like Threshold is doing very poorly in the ratings for CBS. So
not enough to just launch off the web. But then I'm looking here, the same head of CBS research that you mentioned, Aaron Barnhart, David Poltrak. He talked with On the Media, the NPR show, and said that whatever happens, he thinks on-air network television will thrive for the foreseeable future, but that it may eventually fall apart under all this technology. And he says, if it does, if advertisers and marketers abandon it, and this may just be network TV history talking to us, he says he doesn't see anything to replace that entire marketing infrastructure. The economy is going to be diminished. The country kind of coming apart at the seams if that happens.
That's a very dire prediction, but I think that he rightly speaks to the organizing power of broadcast television, for which there really is no replacement, and even with its diminished audience, nothing. You know, nothing has created that kind of shared experience, and possibly nothing ever will, but he is certainly not exaggerating when he says that, you know, they do need to realize new revenues to keep up with the escalating costs of producing the biggest shows in television, and because the budgets on those do keep going up and up, and these new revenue streams are just barely keeping pace with the rise in production costs.
The CEO of Comcast Corporation, Brian Roberts, says the internet has crashed into the television set. We're talking about here whether it's shattered that TV community that's been there, for better or for worse, for decades now. A lot of callers want to join us. Let me turn to them. Bob's calling from Iowa City. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. What do you think, Bob?
Well, I've been getting my TV shows on demand somewhat illegally for quite a while now.
Somewhat illegally. What's that mean?
I've been downloading via things like BitTorrent or other file sharing programs for quite a while.
Yeah, so what do you think?
I think that, first off, I'm really excited to be able to legally pay for these TV shows. It's like when the iTunes service started, I was a lot happier paying 99 cents for a legal version of a song that I knew was going to be very good, as opposed to illegally downloading it.
No more Napstering around in the shadows and wonder when the sheriff's posse would come.
Exactly. Not only that, but I was guaranteed quality, whereas by downloading from a file sharing program, I never knew what I was going to get.
So you're the target here in a way, Bob. Do you think this is going to change the community of Americans who will no longer be watching whatever it would be, Friends at the same hour or Desperate Housewives? Do you think it's going to tear us apart?
I don't think it's going to tear us apart. I think that to a point we are already apart. Like Aaron said earlier about the fact that the top-rated show isn't even drawing the same number of people at the same time watching it as the number 2 or 3 show a number of years ago. We've already experienced that break in our, in the television watching demographic. People aren't huddled around watching Edward Murrow talking about that wacko from Wisconsin anymore.
So it's already happened, you're saying?
Yeah, and this is just giving us a way to make these disparate communities come together again. I remember when Battlestar Galactica was offered for free download on sci-fi.com. Me and my friends all went to download it at the same time, and we were just ecstatic, the fact that we could legally get this show in good quality from the place where it was being broadcast, instead of having to, get it from one source or the other. So as a community, we downloaded that and watched it, together alone, but not in the same way as we did on television.
Together alone, the old American TV watching formula, maybe subdivided dramatically here, but you say bring it on, and we hear it, Bob. Thank you for calling from Iowa City. We're joined now from Brooklyn, New York, by Stephen Johnson. He's author of Everything Bad is Good for You, How Today's Popular Culture is Actually Making Us Smarter. Stephen Johnson, thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So what do you make of this cascade of news from the television industry in the last month and just in the last week? Are we headed for a different kind of TV here? Will it change the kind of programming that gets put out into the world when it goes through, you know, the on-demand of Transformer?
Yeah, I think it will. I mean, I think we've already started to see it happening in a sense, because it's not just the on-demand component of it. It's the idea that there's suddenly a huge economic incentive here to make things that are interesting to watch multiple times, because you're trying to get people, one, to just kind of buy the show and watch it once, just on their own schedule. That's kind of the more traditional way of thinking about on-demand. But think of the ways that the industry has been changed just by kind of DVD sales of hit television shows like The Sopranos or 24 or Six Feet Under. So
make them supple and complex enough that I'm going to shell out my 99 cents in the expectation that I may watch them more than once, the same way people build DVD libraries of movies now?
Yeah, in my book I talked about it as the change from this kind of old model that was sometimes called least objectionable programming from the 70s.
Yeah.
And when you're on TV in the 70s, it was basically like they're just three channels, so all you got to do is make sure that people don't change the channel. So if you confuse them for a second or if you offend them in any way, they might change the channel. So just keep them kind of entertained and amused, and that's how you make your money. Just
and now and next?
The channel.
Yeah.
And now you have what I'm kind of calling most repeatable programming. That's the value. So you want to have a show like The Sopranos, say, that you'll watch once, and then there are about 15 different things you didn't understand, so you buy the DVD and you watch that three times so that you can figure out all the different kind of subtleties in the relationships.
Aaron Barnhart, are you on board with that? Do you think we're going to see not disposable TV anymore, but, you know, buy it, own it, keep it, rewatch it?
Well, this is the $4 million per hour question, isn't it? Can the new economy of on-demand programming keep a revenue stream going so that, you know, big-time TV producers like Jerry Bruckheimer have enough money to go out and make the next CSI? Now, there's no doubt that we'll have plenty of reality programming, because that's relatively inexpensive to make. And in fact, one of my favorite lines in Stephen's book is where he points out that even the junk is more sophisticated now, like Joe Millionaire is a much more textured show than Battle of the Network Stars was in the 1970s. But it doesn't solve the problem about that high-end premium programming. You know, many of the examples Stephen just gave there were of HBO programs. And, of course, those are some of the most expensive programs to produce in all of television.
And supported by voluntary subscription.
And no advertising involved. So how does everybody else get a piece of that action? And that remains to be seen.
Jim Nail, that seems to be a big question mark. I mean, magazines and newspapers are struggling desperately with it right now. People want the information online. They don't expect to pay much or anything for it. Does the TV model, do the production costs get covered as things migrate to this on-demand internet world?
Well, I think what we're seeing here is the TV world starting to look more and more like the movie industry,
in rough shape lately.
Well, it's in rough shape, but what the way their business model has changed over the last, say, 10 or 15 years, it used to be you made money only if people went to the theater and watched it. Now it's kind of covering your costs, and you really make your money on DVD sales and the follow-on rights on, you know, hotel pay-per-view and then in-home pay-per-view, et cetera. So we could see the same thing happen with TV. You know, you can if you can cover your costs with your product placements and some ads and some of the video on demand view for the initial availability of it, great. And then you've got these other revenue streams over time that will really be the profit contributors.
If people will keep coming back, and then of course commercials in there somewhere. Paul's calling from San Jose, California. Hi, Paul. You're on the air. What do you think, my friend?
Hi. Well, my question is about TiVo. I have four TiVos, three of them network, one of them wirelessly network, and I'm curious whether or not there will be pressure to have TiVo include commercial material. There's already some, and there's talk of more.
May I just ask you, Paul, what does a person do with four TiVos? Why four?
Well, we capture a lot of programming, and you know, I have like five episodes of Grey's Anatomy. I just finished watching Rome. I get up early. I was watching Rome around 5 a.m. this morning. I have, you know, like multiple episodes on multiple DVRs, and I can have them whenever I want them. And I don't think I'm alone out here in the valley.
No, I'm sure you're not. You are the new man. Stephen Johnson, how about it? Do you see ads floating off here or horning back in places where they haven't been? TiVo, for example.
Well, I mean, I think, let me just say one thing about this four TiVo phenomenon, which is very interesting. It seems to me that is the kind of thing that will seem in 5 years as kind of bizarre as it must seem to kids today, hearing about how we used to make these mixtapes where we would take our albums and record, you know, and create this playlist, and it would take us hours to make this.
You mean because it'll all just flow naturally over the web? You won't have to have intermediary technology.
The TiVo is kind of a hack that is, again, this bridging technology of trying to kind of capture and store things when we will actually be moving towards this point where it's like, I just want something in your archives, to, you know, for a buck. I'm happy to pay for it, you know, pay you a buck for it. Just send it to me now. I want to watch it.
But Jim Nail, what about the ad question there? Are ads going to be pushed into places where people aren't accustomed to seeing them? Or are we going to see fewer ads overall?
Well, you know, the guiding principle here is that advertising follows eyeballs. So, yes, eventually we will see ads appear. Now, they may not be 30-second spots in the form we're used to. You know, we've seen them kind of bleed out of the commercial pods and into the programming itself in what's called branded entertainment or product placement. But marketers want to get to consumers, and quite frankly, as much as consumers object to advertising clutter, here at Forrester, I just got some data back that kind of surprised me. And we gave consumers some different options of paying for things or exchanging kind of information about themselves to eliminate some of that ad clutter.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of consumers came back and said, gee, you know, I'd be really worried that I might not see an ad for a product I might actually want.
So bring me the ads. After all these decades of moaning about it, we're still going to want the ads in television?
And what's going to happen, but what's going to happen here that's really important is that and back to David Poltrack's comment about sort of the end of civilization as we know it.
Yes.
They're clearly giving themselves more credit than they deserve for
marketing civilization anyway.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. But what's really happening here is that advertisers really don't want to buy viewers of CSI or Lost or Desperate Housewives. You know, they want, let's say, women from the ages of 25 to 54 with household incomes of $50,000 plus.
And the web is going to deliver them somehow, that the downloading will make that more targetable than CSI and others, which have fairly predictable audiences, I guess.
And same thing with cable video on demand. Your cable company knows where you live. Once you do that in sort of classic direct marketing and database marketing form, you can append lots of data about that household. And now marketers will go in, and they won't buy CSI. They'll say, all right, on this Thursday night, I want to reach 8 million viewers with this demographic profile.
So that becomes something more like science and less related to the romance of each show. Jim Nail at Forrester Research, thank you very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Stephen Johnson, is that what you see coming?
Well, I think it's the kind of bleeding out of the Google ad model where, you know, the ads are custom tailored to what you're searching for. And that will, in a sense, become the expected experience that consumers will have, that ads should be responsive to their interests and their needs, and the ad should be actually doing them a service, showing up with information that they want, you know, about products that they're potentially interested in. And so when we see, when that kind of generation of consumers sees old-fashioned mass advertising that is just basically making a broad guess based on some general demographics about the show, the audience that watches a given show, I think that generation will be kind of offended by those ads, by those old-fashioned ads. They'll say, this ad knows nothing about me. Why would I pay any attention to this?
Instead,
but if the ads are custom-tailored to, in a sense, the individual needs of the audience, then I think we'll take them.
A Desperate Housewife speaking directly to you, or you or you. Stephen Johnson, Aaron Barnhart, please stand by. We have to take a short break here. We're talking about TV's on-demand future. Listeners, you can join us. Does it matter if everyone's sitting down to watch Friends or Seinfeld or Desperate Housewives at the same time? Are you prepared to shell out 99 cents a show for what you want when you want it? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've been talking about television's on-demand future and what it means for TV, for you, and for what we will see. You can join the conversation. What will TV look like in 5 years, in 10? Do your television habits look different already? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Aaron Barnhart. He's TV critic for the Kansas City Star. His blog, by the way, is tv-barn.com. Also with us from Brooklyn, New York, Stephen Johnson, author of Everything Bad Is Good for You, How Today's Popular Culture is Actually Making Us Smarter. He's emerging technology columnist for Discovery Magazine. Bob Thompson at Syracuse University is going to be joining us in just a moment. But first, let me get to Jill. She's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Jill. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks a lot for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just have a question. All the programs that you're talking about and that people are talking about enthusiastically being able to download now are all these kind of tried-and-true programs. In the future, in 15 years, how will something become tried-and-true if everybody's just downloading separately at some point?
What do you mean by tried-and-true, Jill?
Well, people know what the programs are. You know, they're going to download Friends or Desperate Housewives. But you have to know about Desperate Housewives. If everybody's just downloading from some amorphous thing and there isn't any real prime time effort to get people to watch the same program at the same time.
If it goes that far, how do you know what the big hit is?
Yeah.
How do you know what's worth going for? Stephen Johnson, what do you say to that?
It's a really good question. I think two things are at work. The first is, one of the things I'm most excited about in this change is that by moving towards the on-demand model, particularly moving towards an internet delivery of some of these programs, is that you enable, in a sense, kind of the large groups of kind of like-minded people to collectively program an entire network, in a sense the way you have people recommending music or books and things like that on Amazon or through iTunes. You'll be able to say, listen, strangers out there who are like me, who share some of my tastes, will you just tell me what I should watch this week?
And how am I going to find out about that, Jill wants to know.
Well, there'll be, I mean, just the way if you go to Amazon right now and you'll get recommendations based on other people's purchasing habits, you'll have millions of services that'll offer those kinds of recommendations to you. So that you end up, instead of listening to some kind of programming guy at NBC sitting in an office somewhere decide what you should be watching tonight, it'll be determined by people who are like you.
Then blogmeisters and thought leaders, and maybe Aaron Barnhart at TVBarn.com.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we forget that the power of the old media is still pretty formidable, and that even though there's a lot more mediums out there, there's, you know, what you just do is you make more appearances on those mediums, and you still have this ability to create publicity. A good example of this are the creators of those little online cartoons, Jib Jab, who Jay Leno discovered them and put them on the Jay Leno show, and of course then people watch the Tonight Show and they see them on with Jay and they book them on their programs, and then you start to have that repeater effect throughout the media sphere. So even though it's more diffuse than it was before, you know, if there's an idea out there that catches people's imagination, there's still going to be the ability to transmit it. You're just going to have to work harder to get your message out, is all.
But lots of ways to hear about it. I guess that will be gushing toward us, Jill. Let me get another caller here. Bill's calling from Falmouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to ask a related question. And Jill asked about sort of branded shows.
Yes.
And I want to ask about finding shows topically by subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I can envision a day where somebody was searching for how to build a deck, and they were able to use a search engine to find your subject matter, which then created seamless links to say, an advertising to Home Depot and then links to Home Depot's website.
And is this something you look forward to, Bill, as a convenience?
Well, you can see from an educational point of view, there's content that's entertainment, there's content that's education, and if I wanted to solve an educational problem or something that I was working on with my children, then I might be driven to search more from a search engine than I am from finding a show by brand.
Absolutely, and we see now Barry Diller's just bought Ask Jeeves, so Mr. TV's thinking about search engines too. Stephen Johnson, how about it? I mean, Google has been driving an awful lot of network fear with the whole idea that they would become masters of this whole great online entertainment universe, and everybody would go through Google and be greeted by their ads, not TV ads.
Well, you get, again, this is one of those interesting places where TiVo is this interesting kind of hack, because you can tell your TiVo that you want to see any Robert Mitchum movie that's on the air at any time, and it'll just record those by default. So in a sense, you're starting to be able to kind of search the available kind of space of shows that are being aired that week and have TiVo kind of automatically record. But I think part of what's going to happen is you're going to start to see the units of shows get broken up. So you'll search and you'll say, look, I just want to see, any interviews with Uma Thurman anywhere just for those 10 minutes, on Today Show or Charlie Rose. Plus, I want to see the opening bit on the Jon Stewart Show. Show me the Daily Show kind of opening 10 minutes. I don't need to see anything else from there. And every morning there'll be like an hour of kind of programming that's been stitched together from parts of shows.
Like selling meals by the bite was the headline.
And for 30 cents instead of a dollar? Sure, that's great.
I want to welcome another voice into our conversation. Bob Thompson joins us. He's professor of TV and popular culture at Syracuse University, director of the study of popular television at Syracuse. Bob, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Bob, we've been talking about TV for a long time. You've seen this cascade of news in the last month, in the last week. Do you see what TV does in our culture changing under this gusher of technological change?
Well, it is changing, but people are talking about these announcements of the last couple of weeks as though this is the big revolution. The revolution started 25 years ago. Before the video cassette recorder, television came into your living room and it was gone. It went out into the ether. You had absolutely no control over it whatsoever. The big moment was the VCR, which means if you tried hard enough and learned how to use your timer and set it and get the light from blinking 12 and all of the rest of it, you could capture that stuff. That was the big moment. You could then put it on your shelf, play it when you wanted, all the rest of it.
But that was pretty clunky compared to what we're talking about now with the power of this broadband, just downpour of stuff from every direction all the time.
True. All of what we've seen now is refinements, but let's take this NBC deal, for example, with DirecTV.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All it lets you do is watch Law & Order, Surface, Monk, The Office, Battlestar Galactica, and you've got to have their plus DVR, which means the same amount of buttons that you could have pushed to simply DVR those things for the whole season, you've now got to push to watch it, later that week, and you can only watch it for a week,
right.
And on top of that, you've got to pay 99 cents for it. So far, and this is all going to change, I do believe we're going to move to an a la carte universe of television delivery, which I think is going to change things dramatically and may be one of the big cultural stories of the first half of this century. But as of right now, it's simply a way to much more easily do the kinds of things that a VCR was letting you do, but it was a lot clunkier, as you say.
I want to ask our other guests about the VCR model, but let me get a call here first, if I may. Fred is calling from Pocatello, Idaho. Hi, Fred, you're on the air.
Hi. My comment is there's a specific type of programming that doesn't seem to fit at all with the on-demand, and that is sports.
Now why sports?
Well, because a sporting event is a live event.
So it's like what Bob Thompson just described. It happens, and then it's over.
And then it's over. So I want to watch the game.
And also because the outcome matters, that who wins and who loses matters in real time to you.
Exactly. And so it seems like it would become increasingly important to the broadcasters, because you have, with a sporting event, a captive audience. I'm there, I'm watching this game at this time, and people all over the country are doing the same thing.
Yeah, and they're hanging in there like for no other show, second by second, to see the outcome. Bob Thompson, what do you say to that?
Sports has become a major part of the network recipe, and that's one of the reasons. On the other hand, when they can start delivering sports to your telephone, also live, then, of course, you can watch the game while you're in the subway and all over the place. But it is true that there are some programs that this isn't going to work for. Once you know who got voted off, whatever the latest reality show is, watching that in demand isn't going to be of that much value. You know, the other thing that I think it's important to remember is that on demand means that you've created some desire for something that people are going to demand.
Yeah.
And in many ways, the old broadcast model, the entire lineup of network television shows, is the advertisement, the promotion for the DVD market, the on-demand market, and all of the rest of it. If, in fact, we take away that playing the palace moment of the network schedule,
mm-hmm.
and all of the marketing and all of the discussion and the buzz that gets created there, the question is, what are you left with for people to demand? And perhaps on-demand and these other models will come up with what TV did. TV got people to buy TV shows with the Milton Berle show.
Mm.
Cable finally got people to break down and get cable when they offered MTV, which could be offered nowhere else. In the end, it's the content, stupid, and we've now got a lot of opportunities to deliver so much more material, but you've got to give somebody something that they want enough to demand in the first place.
We're 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Fred and Pocatello, thanks for your call. Stephen Johnson, what about it? Do you see this, as Bob Thompson does, as a radical extension of the VCR moment? We could record 25 years ago, and now we can just have what we want. However, now it's broadband. Is it the same dynamic or something else here?
Well, I think it's a very interesting point, and I agree with a lot of it. And Bob has written some of the best stuff about the history of TV of anything I've read. And his point about the VCR, I think one of the things that I'm sure he would go on to say is that you can see the effects of the VCR almost immediately in the increase in complexity of shows that started in the 80s, starting with Hill Street Blues, which he's written some wonderful stuff about. So right at the beginning, the second you give people the opportunity to kind of rewind and watch it again, the shows almost immediately start getting more complicated. So I think there is a lot of continuity there. The other thing I would say, though, is that as these shows have grown so complicated, the viewing habit of sitting there and watching one episode and then waiting a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks for the next episode,
mm-hmm.
it comes to seem really off-putting, particularly when you're used to watching shows now on DVD. The shows have become so novelistic in the number of characters, the number of connections, the number of the lack of kind of hand-holding that they have in telling their stories. So they're really much better watched kind of, you know, night after night. You watch a show like The Wire, which is an incredibly complicated show, and you want to watch, you know, each episode, one episode a night, you know, continuously through the season. And it's very hard to do that if you don't kind of control the media in some way. But once you do start watching that way, it's actually much more rewarding because you see the connections, you have the pacing of it is much better, and you see it as a single kind of 12, 15-hour show storyline and not just a series of kind of disconnected 43-minute episodes.
Aaron Barnard, how about it? The whole country's been trained to come back, you know, like the rat to the feed bowl here weekly. Can you imagine people saying, no, I don't want it weekly, save it until you can give it to me all night after night for 14 nights?
Well, as a matter of fact, I have a number of friends, and that's exactly the way that they consume TV now. They hear about a hit show, they wait till the season's over, within about a month or two the DVD is out, and then they catch up with it. The reality is that the viewer credit, they are more sophisticated, and they don't, in fact, return dumbly week after week. If they tune into the show and find out that it's an episode they've already seen, they turn away. And a big problem going forward for network television is the decreasing power of the rerun. Particularly a lot of these serialized shows, there's absolutely no audience there for it, and programs like 24 and Alias have been forced to go rerun-free throughout the season.
And no audience now compared to 20 years ago because there's so many alternatives?
There's so much else to watch that, you know, I saw this happening with reruns of ER about four summers ago, where people just stopped watching repeats of ER because they'd already seen it. And for that to happen during the summer, I thought was amazing. And where this goes in the future, I think, is that no program will be repeated because it's simply not in the network's interest to show it with possible exception of sitcoms, which wear pretty well. But most of the, but these days there are only two sitcoms in the top 25. So clearly, the audience has an appetite for these hour-long dramas. They do not necessarily repeat that well, and we may in fact find ourselves back at the 1950s, where programs didn't repeat, and you know when a show went off the air, another one would come on to take its place till new episodes of the other one.
That's all right by me. I mean, when repeating is built into the system, force-feeding reruns sounds pretty primitive. Marcy's calling from Mechanicsville, Iowa. Hi, Marcy. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just curious of what this is going to do for us ruralites who barely get cable and don't even have the option to have internet access other than dial-up.
Right, so you don't have cable, you don't have broadband internet access. Are you going to be left out of the party? Bob Thompson, how about it?
Well, clearly, that's one big question. The other question are people who can't afford this. I mean, yeah, they're rural people who may not have access, though I think the infrastructures there are probably going to be in place sooner than later. The other is that once upon a time, anybody who could afford a television set and could pay their electric bill could see the entire national drama of that medium. Now, of course, each time you add one of these technologies, your cable, satellite, internet bill goes up. Television on demand, of course, when you're purchasing a la carte, means you've got to pay for it. That's already created kind of a cultural stratification, with HBO offering the best television out and available now, is simply not affordable for some people, even when it comes out in DVD, which are priced pretty premium as well.
Bob, take us, we've just got a couple of minutes here, take us to the furthest extent of that. I mean, you have watched for years now television. You know how it's become this kind of national hearth, even though we're sort of famously alone as we sit around that hearth together. One way or another, this does break up into many more channels, many more shows, less electronic commons in this era. Does it not? Does it change the national culture as
it
a result?
It does, and I don't think we have yet to realize how significant that effect is going to be. When I was a kid, I turned on the TV. There was a State of the Union address. I didn't want to watch it. I flipped the channel. There was a State of the Union address. I flipped the channel. It was on every channel. I watched it simply because I hoped it would be short and they would get back to regular programming, which is what I wanted to watch. But I was forced to kind of watch a State of the Union address. Shows like All in the Family and Roots, which delivered to the mainstream all of the revolutions that the civil rights movement had brought, because everybody was feeding at the same cultural trough at the same time. Those days are pretty much already over, and I think we're all looking at this broken vase of what was American popular culture and trying to figure out what that's going to mean, and I don't think we've got the answer to that yet.
Looking for the glue pot. If it's not TV and popular entertainment, if it's not politics which are polarized, well, we're still looking, and it is a fascinating question. With that, we're out of time. Bob Thompson at Syracuse University, we're very grateful to you for being with us. Thanks for joining us this
hour. Thank you.
And Aaron Barnhart, TV critic for the Kansas City Star. Aaron, good luck to you with your TV work, and thanks for sharing your thoughts with us this hour.
My pleasure.
Stephen Johnson in Brooklyn, author of Everything Bad Is Good for You, emerging technology columnist for Discovery Magazine. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.